Hello and welcome to our IAF podcast. My name is Bettina Solinger and I'm the head of the International Academy for Leadership. You might have wondered already where we are or what has happened to us because we haven't published in a while, and there's a good reason for that. We have been cooking up a new format for you because in the old format, we were discussing seminar topics with the particular guests that were at the Magic Mountain in Gummersbach. But now, with our new format that we label IAF, Continued Conversations, we want to rather continue the conversation and make it available for the broader audience. So we will take seminar topics and discuss them with experts from the seminar, but also with experts that haven't been in Gummersbach before, but that are relevant to the topics that we covered. For that, we assembled a team of different hosts that have different conversations. So Sven and I, we will have conversations about the principles and more conceptual parts of liberalism. Marike and Clinton, they will invite guests to further explore leadership and facilitation skills. And Rainer and Apita, they will do conversations that basically resemble around public policy and global politics. And these three hosts, or rather teams, will introduce themselves in the upcoming episodes. So don't worry if you haven't been in one of their seminars. They will give you an overview of who they are in the introductory episode of their team. But now we will dive into today's topic, which is the global state of liberalism and where we are as liberals. For that, we invited a wonderful and, may I say, the perfect guest to kick us off with our first episode of IAF Continued Conversations. Sven, you might want to introduce our guest to the audience.
Yes, well, we have Tom Palmer with us. Tom is a great role model to many in the liberal family, including myself. And I would do many mistakes introducing Tom because he has so many different hats on. I mean, not literally hats, but like he has so many different roles in the global liberal family. So I would ask Tom to say a couple of words about yourself, because I think that is more charming than me introducing you more formally. So Tom, maybe give us a little bit of a pitch. What are you doing and what is your role in the global liberal family?
I've been involved in the liberal movement for over 50 years, which shocks me sometimes when I think back. That sounds like such a long time. And yet at the same time, it seems like it only began a few weeks ago. So I was active in activism causes, all the ones you could normally imagine, against conscription and against the legalization, against the prohibition of marijuana and for equal rights for everyone and so on and so forth, and limited government and a reduction of the burdens of the state. And I also took an interest in the ideas of liberty. So I went, put myself through college and then another college degree and then another college degree. And my interest in liberty was always at the core of what I was thinking about and writing about and engaging with other views and learning the other perspectives as well as I could. I'll just give you a little anecdote. When I was very young, a wonderful lady helped me to get books. Before the internet, there were people who'd go and look for used books and make lists on mimeograph and send them out. And she was a great lady. Her name was P.K. Slocum, P.K. for Priscilla Slocum. When she started in the 1950s, she thought people wouldn't buy books from a woman. So that tells you how the world has changed so much in such a positive way. But not only did she sell me books and many books about liberty, she was a great friend of free society, but she also would send to me books by anti-liberals that she thought I should read as a teenager. So she sent me Lenin, Engels, Marx, Trotsky, Stalin, and Mussolini, and Gentili, and other fascist thinkers as well. She said, these people hate our freedom and you really need to understand them. And not too long ago, I was in my library and I had to go look at a statement by Lenin and the state and revolution. And it really touched me when I opened it. I saw her penciled inscription. It was a gift from her to Tom from Comrade PK. And it was important to her, and I picked this up, to understand the other side and why they reject the ideas of liberty and spontaneous order and limited government and toleration. And so I've been involved in this movement for a long time, and I've taken a strong interest in the cosmopolitan element of liberalism. That was a topic of my doctoral dissertation, was cosmopolitanism and justice. And I've also basically held lots of the jobs and positions you could have in promoting liberty, going to difficult places. I just got back from Ukraine on the weekend, and I've been in Afghanistan and other places suffering from violence, because I learned something as a boy, which is I'm not too good to do the work that needs to be done. And if it needs to be done, I'm willing to do my best to do it on behalf of the cause of equal liberty and justice for everyone in the world.
Yeah, and this global perspective, and in the especially fields where liberalism struggles, is exactly the topic of our conversation. And you are the perfect guest to talk through this, because we see that the state of liberalism at the moment doesn't look too rosy. So in a sense, I take a little bit of a pessimistic view, because when I look around and if I engage with my liberal friends from all over the world, it seems to me that we have distinct struggles that we don't have good answers to. So on a more conceptual level, what we see out there at the moment after the European elections, but globally, is that there is really this phenomenon of populism deeply manifested in our society, right? So we don't only have the traditional populism of Latin America or then like Donald Trump, for example, but we have it really manifested in the European Parliament. We have it in Africa. We have it in the MENA region. Let's think of Tunisia, for example. We have it in some parts of Asia. And of course, we have the hardcore authoritarian part of Russia on top. So populism as a distinctively illiberal political agenda is everywhere and is here to stay, it seems. And then on a second layer, I see that we have now a real challenge on the level of international institutions. I was reading a study by the Arab Barometer, which kind of tracks public sentiment in the Arab world. And here we can see that in certain countries, the term the West or liberal values are perceived as something derogatory or toxic to a certain degree, and that, for example, China is gaining reputational, not like real world influence, but also reputational influence in the region, that people prefer, for example, China as a partner over the United States, and therefore, to a certain degree, one might argue, liberal values. So these are kind of the two things that we want to carve out together with you: how the state of liberalism looks like, or the state of liberty in the world in 2024 and beyond. So I gave you a bit of my pessimistic spiel. And like usually, I mean, I'm German, right? Like I have the German angst. Like I have this anxiety that the world is going down. Do you share the same sentiment, Tom?
I certainly share the sentiment that we're on the back foot in many ways. There's no question about that. I don't share a long-term pessimism, although I think things are likely to get worse before they get better. The two elements that you discussed are actually deeply entwined. And we have seen the rise of populism as an ideological tool for the seizure of power. Populism is based on the notion that there's the true people who are somehow victimized by some enemy, often hidden. It can be the Jews or the Masons or the international bankers or the 1% or the, in America, the M&Ms, the Muslims and Mexicans who are allegedly destroying America and so on. But then that is weaponized by illiberal states in which autocratic figures have seized power, and they use it to disrupt the liberal democracies by making it more difficult for people to live together, by accentuating divisions and promoting the idea of the enemy, that there's us, the real people, and there's a left-wing version, a right-wing version of this, and then there's the enemy, and that those people must be extinguished, destroyed, annihilated, not find a way to live together, but they are the existential enemy. This has are drawn on a ideology form of power formulated by such figures as Carl Schmitt, and then Ernesto Laclau, a particularly odious Argentine political thinker who was a Peronist, a Marxist, and then a post-Marxist, a populist, but basically an advocate of authoritarianism. And he argued that what you wanted to do was to create a what he called an empty signifier. By the way, the book is remarkably badly written trash, in my opinion, but I slogged through it twice, which meant that it would give unity to a whole series of inchoate, unrelated, angry demands. People demand things. He says, that's the basis of politics. I want more money. I want more this. I want the this and the other thing. They don't have to cohere except through a leader, the empty signifier, which means Juan Perón, Mussolini, Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, Viktor Orban. That is what gives unity. And it focuses all this anger on an enemy. And as he points out, that we create, and also his wife Chantal Mouffe was another totalitarian theorist, we create the people by choosing the enemy. So this is a political strategy. It's not an ideology of the old sort like communism or old-fashioned conservatism and so on. It's an ideology of power per se, in which we create the people by designating an enemy and use that to seize power. Now, this global illiberal alliance has weaponized this very effectively. So the Russian state in particular supports virtually all of the bitterly illiberal movements in the world, whether they're far left or far right. We can find the traces of Kremlin influence, financing, and support through disinformation. So there is a global assault on liberalism. The populism is a tool of this assault that has then, and I'll end this long-winded comment with a thought, there are, of course, fractures within free societies that have emerged that are the basis that can be exploited by these states and movements. And those are worth exploring, but I don't think that populism was just somehow a natural and inevitable outcome of those changes in society.
So in a sense, if I understand you correctly, like my hypothesis is always that it is a twofold problem. There's the domestic challenge to liberal democracy, and that comes out of, for example, liberal democracy not always delivering according to the promises. And we have seen, to a certain degree, economic stagnation in certain societies, and then populism kind of as a side effect arose. And then on the other side, we see a disillusionment with the liberal international order that also again comes into trouble, especially with an actor like such as the United States that is retreating from the global scene to a certain degree. If we look at, for example, the recent events in the last couple of years in Afghanistan or Iraq and stuff like that, right? So these are distinct challenges in my books, but you seem to connect them and say, okay, you know, like there's a global assault on liberalism, and the populists are actually just to a certain degree the helpful idiots to a certain degree to this global anti-liberal alliance. Do I understand? Do I make sense of that correctly? Or
yes, I think so. And someone who's articulated this, I think, quite well and documented it is Anne Applebaum. Her newest book, Autocracy Incorporated, The Dictators Who Want to Run the World, makes these connections, I think, very effectively. So when there are social divisions, they are exploited. You think about the fissures or cracks in society. The Kremlin and others have put big wedges into those, or crowbars, if you will, to make them wider and wider and wider. To give one simple example from the 2015-2016 electoral cycle or election campaign in the United States, you had one Facebook account based in Russia, Rostov-on-Don, that promoted, using the same images, two different messages, which are messages of social division. An African-American self-defense instructor had been hired over the internet. He only spoke once with the person. He said, oh, I had a Russian accent, but he didn't think about it, to train African-Americans in self-defense, perfectly normal thing to do, but take lots of pictures. That was the key, lots of pictures. of them with firearms and engaging in self-defense. These were then weaponized. They were sent out to demographically Caucasian rural areas to say the blacks are getting ready for warfare, protect yourself. They're coming to take you and, you know, your white daughters and all that sort of horror. And then they were also sent to African-American demographics to say, we have to be ready because the whites are after us and we have to arm. And these were deliberate attempts to create so not only social tension, but violence and hatred in society. That's one tiny example of hundreds of thousands. And since that time, when you could sometimes identify through the misuse of the grammatical mistakes that a native Russian would use in writing in English or German, like lack of definite articles and so on, you could sometimes identify this is clearly from St. Petersburg. Now with artificial intelligence, it's impossible. They write in perfect German or even in dialect or English or Polish or Spanish or anything else. And so you have huge numbers of people appearing on social media saying, well, I'm a homemaker in Cleveland or outside of Dusseldorf or something, and I'm sick and tired of all of these immigrants, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And supporting far-right political movements or, when it suits them, far-left political movements with alternative messages. And so this really is an interlocked system. Think about the global alliance that has emerged. And what do they have in common in traditional ideological terms? Russia, Iran, China, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, i.e. North Korea, Cuba, Venezuela, and then Hamas, Hezbollah, their various proxies around the world. What do they have in common? Well, what they have in common is their hatred of liberalism, but in particular, these are all criminal enterprises that are focused on the enrichment of their leaders. These are mafia states in every case, including China. Xi Jinping and others have become billionaires by looting the Chinese people. Of course, think about Kim Jong-un living, stuffing his face with cakes while children are starving around him. And then Maduro and all of the boligarchs, as they're called in Venezuela, the Castro crime family, that is a family of centimillionaires, if not billionaires, by having looted and destroyed Cuba. What they care about is money. Money and power, the things that you can get with those. And that also makes them especially dangerous. There is nothing they would not do to protect their access to those resources. And populism is fundamentally now a tool of those movements to secure their continued existence of lucre and plunder. Last point, one of the reasons for the attack on Ukraine by the Kremlin didn't have to do with gay pride parades and that sort of thing per se. It was the general existence of Ukraine as a relatively free, relatively open society on the borders of a dictatorial kleptocracy, which is what Russia is. And as Vladimir Klitschko put it, he says, our very existence is a threat to Putin's hold on power, because it's an example of what is possible. And therefore, they need to exterminate and snuff out liberal democracy any place it could exist as a counterexample to their system of organized theft and exploitation.
I mean, to a certain degree, and I see Bettina also has a question, but like just because you kind of answered with your last point one challenge that I would have put to you, and that is in the past, I thought, okay, this kind of interest-oriented analysis of the kleptocrats, that makes sense. Like if we look at Vladimir Putin, if we look at North Korea, and if we look at all the other kind of self-enriching autocrats. But then, of course, the Russian invasion of Ukraine happened, and if we look at the repercussions that had for the Russian oligarchic class, which are part of this whole kleptocracy, right? It's not just one leader, but like also the people that this particular leader takes in the political system. Then the repercussions seem to make up a calculation that doesn't seem to be favorable of taking this step, Okay, right. That would be always my counter argument. But if I understand you correctly, you would argue and say, well, just the proximity of a liberal democracy and the kind of the smell of possibility of what is possible in potentially in Russia is the was the danger itself, according to your assessment. Because otherwise, it is hard to explain why Vladimir Putin decided to invade Ukraine, right? Because on a purely economic interest-based calculation, that seems because of all the repercussions, sanctions, freezing of central banking assets, like the kind of personal sanctions, it doesn't seem to make much sense.
You're about 20 years out of date and understanding this in the following way. Russia
Only
is not
20.
only 20, but there's always a time lag. That's why Bernie Sanders keeps talking about socialism, and he mentioned Denmark and Sweden, which
I
have
feel
more.
flattered. I feel flattered.
Yeah, it's more free market economies than the United States in many ways, with more robust protection of property rights in those countries than you see in the US, certainly in Sweden. In this case, Russia is not run by oligarchs. It's run by the Siloviki, the men of force. And those people are a different class. They're the ones who control the interior ministry, police, the security apparatus, the army, and so on. And Putin is surrounded by those people. Think people like Deripaska or the other businessmen are their servants, and everything they have is on their sufferance. He humiliates them periodically. Deripaska was a classic example where he was called to account on television like a schoolboy brought up to the principal's desk for a spanking. It was totally humiliating for him. And he was establishing we people who can exercise violence, we the ones who can kill. We're the ones who have the power. And all the rest of you are here, and you can get very rich so long as you serve us. So it's not run by the oligarchs per se. It's Putin and the Siloviki, these men of force. And of course, there's this circle around him, all of whom hate him, and he hates and fears all of them. It's very difficult for an absolute dictator who got to power by killing his predecessors and opponents to have friends, as I think we generally understand. I suspect he doesn't have any. It must be a miserable, lonely existence from at least my perspective. But he is quite willing to sacrifice the interests of those people. And do recall, by the way, that prior to the invasion, the message was sent out for all of those people to liquidate their holdings abroad and to turn them into cash, gold, Bitcoin, and so on, and reinvest them in Russia. So he did give them a little bit of a warning, but there's sacrificial victims if need be. He doesn't care about them very much. That's not where his power base is. It rests rather on his ability to control force and the media. Those are the really key elements. And then their control of the financial system for the enrichment of himself and those who really exercise force. So the last point, though, there was a miscalculation on Putin's part. All the evidence points to him truly believing it would be a quick victory in less than a week, and then maybe a couple of weeks of mopping up, and then they would have this compliant puppet state, somewhat closer to what Belarus has. That didn't turn out. One of the reasons was the corruption that Putin has promoted is so endemic that the billions that were spent from the state budget to suborn Ukrainians and to bribe officials and so on, some of that worked. There were Russian agents within the Ukrainian government and so on who were on the payroll. But a lot of it evidently disappeared into the pockets of the generals and the Siloviki themselves. So they said, yes, we spent a lot of money, and it went into a yacht instead. And then related to that, when you have absolute power to have people liquidated for fun, which is what happened to Navalny was a little present from Putin to Putin to kill Navalny after his phony victory in the election. No one wants to tell you the truth. This is a big weakness of dictatorships. People fear the dictator, and they don't want to say anything unpleasant to him, anything that contradicts what he wants to be the case. And so everyone around Putin apparently told him, oh, it's easy, don't worry. And then they were shocked when he did it, and then found out that the Ukrainians were capable of and certainly willing to fight for their independence and against subjugation by the Kremlin. So this was a mistake that is deeply rooted in the dynamics of dictatorship. They cut themselves off from access to information. Something similar, by the way, is happening in China with Xi Jinping. They eliminated the collective leadership within the Communist Party. It wasn't a democracy by any means, or far from it, but at least behind closed doors, there was conversation and there were factions and people would discuss things. And then when the party leader stepped out, everyone behind the party leader was a man, all of them male, but they were younger than the party leader who emerged as the new leader, which meant there would be a continuity of leadership. Xi Jinping eliminated that. And I recall the party congress when he came out and everyone behind him was older. This was a signal. I'm it. I have absolute power. Everything depends on me personally. And now we have his low-level thought promoted everywhere through Xi Jinping thought and compulsory Xi Jinping study groups at the companies and firms and the army and everything. The guy's not that deep, certainly not that bright, but he's ruthless. The consequence of this, however, is he is also cutting himself off from information about the domestic situation in China and about China's international position. And over the long term, this is harmful to these states.
So we covered a lot of ground here already. I understand that the coming to power and the holding on to power by whatever means is not powered by any ideas for the future or ideological ideas, neither in Russia nor in China, except maybe, I'm not sure whether that's correct, but it seems there are dreams around about hegemonial powers who divide the world between them, and all the others have to arrange with this new alignments or ancient alignments that they want to rebuild in a way. Is that just a narrative to convince their own followers and population, or is that something that goes deeper and is really driving them? That would be of interest to me.
Well, I think it is both. It is a narrative that appeals to certainly parts of the world that say, oh, the world order has not been favorable to us. In some cases, that's a fair enough critique, and says we'll have a multipolar world, a world of sovereignty and respect and so on. And this is promoted in order to destroy what has been called the rules-based order. It's an imperfect term for an imperfect global order. But what emerged after the Second World War and developed over time of some notion that there are limits to what states may do. And now what is being promoted, this word that has reemerged in the geopolitical discourse of sovereignty. It's very interesting because everyone is going to get sovereignty, every state. But Putin made it very clear recently. He says, not all states have sovereignty. Russia has sovereignty. Because what sovereignty means is not only that no one can criticize you, certainly no one can intervene inside, no one can even be critical. They claim it's a violation of their sovereignty when we point out that he's a murderous thug, that somehow a violation of Russian sovereignty. But a sovereign state can then invade and annex other states because they do not have sovereignty. Mm. What it means is fundamentally the rule of pure violence in the international scene. And this is a terrifying notion that the world may plunge not into a multipolar get together, a kind of sitting around the campfire experience. But their notion of multipolarity is a world of unrestrained violence and invasion and attacks on other states by the states that are sovereign against the states that are not sovereign, as opposed to the so-called rules-based order that at least, even though It was violated on a number of occasions, had a general presumption of the Westphalian order having some legitimacy in the sense that states should not just march armies across borders and annex parts of other states. Now, reasonably, someone who's critical of that, and I am as well, would say, well, look at all of the counterexamples, the cross-border wars, the acts of the American government that have been invading other states and so on. And I take all those points very seriously. I think those are typically quite gross violations of those fundamental principles. The invasion of Iraq is a good example. Saddam Hussein was a despicable tyrant and a exceptionally cruel murderer. But that did not by itself justify the thought that it could be then invaded by the so-called coalition of the willing on spurious grounds, with the fantasy notion that once you got rid of the dictator, every place would end up like Baden-Württemberg or Oregon or something like that, that they'd just be the very peaceful place where people could more or less get along. That was based on ignorance and foolishness on the part of the political leaders in the United States, United Kingdom, and elsewhere that orchestrated that. That said, that the exceptions were exceptions to a general rule, and the general rule is now under attack. Any state can invade, conquer, and annex any other state. This is the new idea of sovereignty being promoted by China and Russia. Russia especially, the Chinese state is a little bit more hesitant, but their aggressiveness in the so-called South China Sea is an example that they may move in that direction as well.
Yeah. So if you want to predict or like look a little bit ahead into the future, do you think that this kind of more geopolitical world, as I would call it, is kind of the revival of traditional geopolitics, right, where this kind of interest-based violence will be at the forefront rather than the rules-based engagement with each other. Do you think that this kind of geopolitical world will become even more dominant in the future, or is there a chance back for the rules-based international order, as you would call it? Do we see kind of because there's also a chance of the revival of liberal values, right? We see that actually within the European Union, for example, the Russian invasion of Ukraine sparked some more awareness of what liberal democracy has created and what the European values are, right? So it's a split picture, I must admit, especially now after the European election. But there was this initial spark, at least, to say, well, we have to stand up for liberal values, especially right now. So what do you see more dominating in the future? The more geopolitical world or the one that is doing a return to the international rules-based order?
Well, I just want to point out, more geopolitical world sounds very anodyne, very clinical. I would think of it as a world of violence, which is, I think, a more accurate term. I think we're on a knife edge, and it really could go either way. So I'm neither optimistic nor pessimistic in this regard, certainly over the short run, I would consider the next 5 to 10 years. I think that one of the important battlegrounds is an actual battleground, and that is the defense of Ukraine. If the Russian state is successful in this and the Ukrainians are defeated or forced to become a little puppet rump state with huge loss of territory filled with Russian colonists, and I'll just be very frank, genocide against the Ukrainian nation, which is what is the goal. They have committed genocide already, kidnapping children, depriving them of their names, punishing them for speaking their language, telling them their parents are dead when they're not, and so on and so forth. That and the destruction of Ukrainian books, which are consigned to the fire from libraries and schools, and the torture of ministers, religious leaders, of political figures, journalists, the executions, and so on. This is genocide. If they are successful, I think that that will continue and will become the norm. It'll establish a new kind of semi-equilibrium among violent states. But I think that Europe will be pushed back, and Ukraine would not be the last country to fall if they are successful. On the other hand, if there is strong support of Ukraine and the Ukrainians can continue to defend their independence militarily, I think that we are in a much better position to defend our principles and ideals. And it will be a huge setback to this new world disorder based on violence, conquest, annexation, and genocide. So I think that the battleground is not only intellectual, it is also a real battleground. I think very much about how important it was to defeat National Socialism in Europe. It was such a horrifying war. Germans understand the suffering that was imposed by the German state on other people, but then also came to the German people themselves, the destruction of cities, the loss of lives, the horrors that all of Europe went through that was involved in that monstrous war. But National Socialism had to be defeated. It had to be militarily defeated. It has to be crushed to the ground. And I think that if Ukraine is successful in defeating Russian invasion, the Russian state is likely to crumble. And this will be a great thing for the advance of liberty, although there will be uncertainty and disorder within Russia itself. I'll mention one other element, that just an anecdote that comes to mind. I recently taught at a program, a summer school, with very smart advanced high school students from all around the world. And one from China raised an issue, very smart young lady, but kind of puzzled because she'd never heard the idea of discussion being promoted. And she said, well, discussion leads to disorder, and disorder leads to chaos, and chaos leads to revolution, and revolution means destruction of everything. Therefore, we shouldn't have discussion. I said, well, of course, this is what you're taught in China today. She said, well, this is what our history teaches us. And I said, well, you might want to think about the horrors imposed by communism. And I mentioned Frank Decoder's book, Mao's Great Famine, the astonishing mass extinction of huge regions of Chinese population through deliberate starvation, one of the greatest crimes of the millennia, frankly, was the so-called Great Leap Forward and the tens of millions killed in that period, and all of the other horrors that they were subjected to. She was thinking about it, but I said it would be wise to read books not published by the Communist Party of China. But when you return to China, to be very discreet about that, but think about them. And when you're abroad, read them, and then be careful when you return to China, because you know what will happen to you if you express those ideas. So I am neither optimistic nor pessimistic in the short term. It depends on what happens, in my opinion, in Ukraine. And the other one, of course, is Venezuela. The opposition has the proof that they won. Even left-wing Maduro-oriented governments in Latin America have not stepped forward to endorse Maduro's power seizure. They said, oh, we want to see the evidence. If Maduro stays in power because of the support of Iran, Russia, China, and Cuba, this would be a big setback. If he leaves power, one hopes to go off to some retirement in another autocracy and have all the hookers and champagne and steaks that he wants and fancy cigars and everything, then Venezuela will have a chance. And this will be another body blow against this global illiberal movement. But we wait to see what's going to happen in those two cases.
Yeah, so huge challenges that we are in the middle of now, and even bigger challenges to come. Liberals have great ideas to offer, and we also showed that they work and that they help people to prosper, to to unfold their potential, to better their existence, the whole modernization and also economic development of the world, from my point of view, is based on liberal ideas, peaceful exchange, tolerate different kinds of lifestyles that people choose themselves, and so on. And this is under threat right now because we see all those, the power play, the installment and ignition of fear. Fear means you put people into a state where they don't really think about their choices, but they just come into a position of reaction to threats. Liberals are also kind of people who think a bit more ideologically and trying to argue against other ideas and come up with, you know, the effort to persuade others of maybe think differently instead of forcing them to do what others want. So for me, the big question is, what do we do with this situation? And how can we liberals promote liberal ideas when the ground is not very fertile in many regions or in many heads to be open enough to engage in a debate, in an exchange of ideas, just looking for safety and for cover and for someone who protect them. And so how do we deal with the situation? You said you had hope. It might become worse before it becomes better, but we also should prepare to make it become better and reintroduce more liberty and peaceful exchange and open-minded thinking with each other and so on to bring about the betterment. So what are your takes on that?
Well, I'll give you first a kind of pessimistic one and then an optimistic one. When I say we, I mean the liberal movement, not any of us, we're not that old, but in a sense, we have been there before. If you look at the enormous transformation in the 18th and 19th centuries of the world through liberalism, elimination of slavery, the elimination of serfdom, the liberation of the Jews, the establishment of religious toleration, and then the fantastic increase in living standards and longevity that was achieved, and everything across the board became better for virtually everyone. Literacy rose, women were liberated. It was incomplete, but the trend was so powerful.
Yeah.
Many people forgot why that had happened. So E.L. Godwin, Edwin L. Godkin, who was the editor of The Nation magazine, which at the time was a liberal magazine, it later got taken over and became very left-wing, even communistic, and is quite a socialist magazine today, but at the time was a very liberal magazine. And in the year 1900, he wrote an essay on the eclipse of liberalism, and I encourage people to look it up on the internet and find it. He pointed out that people had become accustomed to the material benefits and the progress made possible by liberalism. As he said, to the principles and precepts of liberalism, the prodigious material progress of the age was largely due. Freed from the vexatious meddling of governments, men devoted themselves to their natural task, the bettering of their condition, with the wonderful results which surround us. But it now seems that its material comfort has blinded the eyes of the present generation to the cause which made it possible. In the politics of the world, this is 1900, liberalism is a declining, almost a defunct force. So this is really quite terrible. He says, only a remnant, old men for the most part, still uphold the liberal doctrine, and when they are gone, it will have no champions. Now, this is quite terrifying. And even the most awful element was what he wrote in anticipation of the near future. He said, the old fallacy of divine right has once more asserted its ruinous power And before it is again repudiated, there must be international struggles on a terrific scale. Well, of course, think about World War I. What a nightmare. And then World War II. The horror that people lived through. So that's the pessimistic take on this. The optimistic take is we should be able to learn from history and revive liberalism as something that is exciting, something that offers progress and positive benefits for the bulk of humanity, not to take for granted that the things that have been produced by the opening of trade and the market economy and social progress, we should just take for granted. Many of these things are deeply under threat. And we're seeing this now in a number of countries where liberties that people were taken for granted, liberties of women to control their own lives, liberty of gay and lesbian people and others, sexual minorities to just live peacefully as they want to live. These are very much under threat by far left and far right movements, by the way. If you look at Romania, the Romanian Socialist Party made an alliance with the extremist elements of the Orthodox Church to ban same-gender marriage. Fortunately, it failed. That was a small victory for us. But these movements coalesce in their hatred of personal freedom and victimization of groups. Those things are at risk. And I think we need to mobilize people to understand that the whole society is right now under threat. The ability to live together peacefully with your neighbors is under threat. And with it, the material progress that was made possible by that. We need to make that case and make that case stronger and stronger. And we need to have a positive agenda to address some of those things that have created the fissures, the cracks in society, the failures, if you will, that are being exploited by illiberal powers. I'll give one very concrete sort of policy wonk example of that, not high level ideology. But in most urban parts of the world, it's not just Europe and North America, it's just about everywhere, housing is becoming increasingly expensive. And so that young people find, you know, my parents could buy a house, my grandparents had a home, why can't I get one? Why do I have to wait until I'm 35 saving up money for a down payment? This is because of the growth of NIMBYism, not in my backyard, we don't want people building homes near us. Everyone wants to protect the character of the neighborhood, as they put it. They say, oh, we're all for low-income housing, but not here, not where I live. Repeal those restrictions. If you look at the charts that plot new housing starts and housing prices, it's like the letter X. Housing starts go down and prices go up. Well, duh, this is supply and demand. If you want prices to go down, increase supply. And I think that we could address some of this social discontent, especially among younger people who feel the system is rigged against them, because it is. It is rigged against them. Older generations have a house and they don't want younger people or other people to be able to build around them. So it is a rigged game, and we need to address that in a very strong way and open up markets to allow supply to meet demand. This, I think, is a kind of policy wonk solution that we should champion and push very strongly. And it's happening in some parts of the United States and other countries as well. That's an area where we can be successful. And then we have to point out, lastly, that these figures like Viktor Orban, who's a kleptocrat himself, has enriched himself and his family at the expense of Hungarian taxpayers, but also European Union taxpayers, because they suck money out of the EU. And I think Balint Magyar's book establishes this very, very well as a post-communist mafia state. It's a very good treatment, a little bit dated now, but of how Orban cemented his power through a privilege and distribution of largesse. And then a very good book released more recently, Black Book 2, on corruption and state capture in Hungary by Civitas and Transparency International, that gives example after example of the way in which a crony class is stealing and enriching themselves. And more people need to understand this, that Viktor Orban and the others claim that they're standing up for traditional society. What they're doing is using that to steal.
Yeah, on the other hand, their narrative is, that others are guilty of that. And one of the guilty party is the liberal world order, globalization, open borders, and their recipe would be to renationalize, to build wealth in the own country and protect it against others. And that seems to be an idea that is simple enough to, as a quick fix, to believe that, you know. And we see that everywhere in Germany, in other countries. Jobs for the Germans, houses for the Germans. Why are we engaged in the world that brings nothing but misery and people to Germany who don't belong here? And we hear the same narrative in other European and other countries around the world. So renationalization, building walls, metaphorically or in real, seems to be the more attractive ideas. Because the narrative is, you know, the globalization, open borders, liberal democracy is exactly the culprit that brought us into that difficult situation. So we need to try something else.
Yeah, and maybe building upon Bettina's question, I think in general, we have a cynicism also towards politics that is induced by this kind of political discourse, where we say, well, you know, like, we are enriching ourselves, but we all know kind of politics is just about enriching oneself. So the cynicism about politics that is induced by these actors is kind of fueling this whole narrative. And so I think Viktor Orban gets away with it because people understand, okay, the others are the same way too, right? And that's why all of these stories about Hunter Biden and whatever are so relevant, right? And that's why they are deliberately put forward at the discourse, so that people get a sense of, well, it's those or those doesn't matter, or these or those doesn't matter, because in the end they're all just there to enrich themselves, right? And so this kind of cynicism towards politics is then perfected in a country like Russia, where this kind of politics is just a theater, basically.
Well, essentially what we have to face is the old logical fallacy of the pardon my mad Latin pronunciation, tu quoque, or tu quoque, or however one would say it, you too. Or whataboutism, mm-hmm. is the contemporary term. If you point out some criminal act, they say, what about, and then they point to something bad in another country. If you mention the genocide against Uyghur people in China, the extinction of their culture, punished for speaking their language, for having beards, for worshiping their own Islamic faith, and so on, then they say, what about Ferguson, Missouri, which was a terrible crime in the United States? Or what about George Floyd, a man who was murdered by a policeman, as people made videos of it on their phones, begging the policeman to stop? They say, what about that? What about that? And the response is, yes, those are terrible things. And in a liberal free society, there are systems to correct that. There's a reason why the officer who did that is in prison right now. It's not to say there's always perfection and nothing bad ever happens. So we do need to address that directly and say that democratic orders have self-correcting mechanisms. Not that they're perfect, not that no injustices take place, but they can be corrected and addressed in a system which people are free to petition their government for redress of grievances, to change the government through deliberation and the democratic voting and so on. So that's a very important part of this. The other element is, that's why I think we need an active liberal agenda. We cannot be merely reactive to them.
No.
I think that we need to promote opening markets for housing, which I think is one of the many factors driving this populism. It creates a kind of crack, dissatisfaction, a sense of unfairness, which I think is quite right. It is unfair. And then that is exploited by populist forces, and those populist forces frequently receive encouragement from illiberal states. So let's have a positive liberal agenda of opening markets, a positive liberal agenda of freeing trade, and explaining to people that this lowers your taxes. It used to be the case in England that the Liberal Party had posters that said free trade raises wages. That is true, and it is important for us to stress it again. You did mention the issue of immigration, which many people find disturbing, and I think there needs to be a liberal approach to this as well. And it isn't just the one that is intuitively appealing to some people, just open borders, anyone can go where they want. Like between Belgium and France today, I'm old enough to remember driving between Belgium and France and France and Germany and so on, and those idiotic border posts where you had to show a passport and customs and all that. I hated that. So much better now to drive through Europe and not have that problem. So that is a much better approach. What we have, though, is at many borders, chaos, and people see chaos and it scares them. This chaos, by the way, is also, to some extent, a deliberate creation of liberal states. The Russian state murdered people in Syria. They destroyed an entire UN convoy of aid through with Syrian jets, killed all of the aid workers and destroyed all of the aid. They bombed the hospitals in Aleppo. They dropped chlorine gas bombs on people. Why? Not only to assert the power of Bashar al-Assad's mafia state, but to drive refugees into Europe with the hope that it would destabilize European politics. And to some extent, it has done that. And similarly, look at the American southern border. If Maduro stays in power, the 8 million people who have already fled that country will be joined by possibly as many as 5 million more. Russia wants this, I should say more accurately, Putin wants this. He wants continued destruction of Venezuela. It's a useful failed state for him. He can have military bases there. They can do their drug smuggling and other activities that the Kremlin sponsors. But also 5 million refugees fleeing a failed state is a weapon of the authoritarians. They will use it to destabilize Colombia, to destabilize other states in the region, and most especially directing them to the United States of America to create these scenes of chaos that then drive a kind of protective response. The people say, oh my God, look at what's happened. We don't control our borders. So I think there needs to be a liberal approach to cross-border movement and migration that is orderly and perceived to be orderly and not chaotic. That's an area where I think that liberal democratic states need to do a better job of addressing the immigration issue. If not, it will address us and sweep us away. That's not to say immigration restrictions. It means an orderly procedure rather than people streaming across in huge numbers who are then videotaped and presented as waves of invaders.
And to a certain degree, the normalization of the discourse around migration, it seems to me at the moment in many, especially Western liberal democracies, the topic of migration is so highly polarizing. There is no nuance in this whole debate. And just one example to add, because I think Lukashenko is one of the most blatant examples of like kind of state terrorism, where people from Iraq were brought in and then sent to the Polish border, right? Just to cause chaos and like to kind of show what about this and show like, okay, is the European Union really as open and liberal and tolerant as they claim to be? Well, here are some refugees. I mean, again, these were people that were deliberately brought in, right? And then rightfully pushed back by the Polish authorities at that point, right? Because this was a deliberate attempt by the Belarusian government at that point. But anyways, we have talked a lot about the autocrats of the world, and we dropped too many names of people that are deeply unpleasant. Let's close with a little bit of more hopeful messaging. And maybe, Tom, through all of your work, you encounter a lot of inspirational human beings, liberals all around the world. We talked about the challenges that liberals faces or that liberalism faces. What are some of the hopeful anecdotes that you can tell, like, or like the islands of hope, I sometimes call them, you know, where liberal communities flourish in our ecosystem. So far, we talked a lot about the challenges and that we liberals have to get our shit together to a certain degree. But like, what are some of the things that you encountered recently that is inspirational?
Well, let me mention a couple of successful cases. When I say successful, it doesn't mean perfect or I love it 100% or everything that's happened is beautiful. This is, of course, the problem in much discourse. If there's any flaw in anything, people immediately go to a totalitarian solution. I don't, but I consider these to be successes in the context of the political struggle. In Poland, the Law and Justice Party was establishing essentially a one-party state, and they were defeated at the polls. This was really their last chance, in a way. The current government is a mixed government that has a lot of policy positions I'm not happy about. But what an improvement, because they secured their liberal democracy and the idea of competitive elections and the largest vote turnout in the history of the country. Really quite impressive. And then in Greece, where you had a coalition government of the far left and the far right, Syriza, which is really, in my opinion, quite a scary movement of Maoists, Trotskyists, Stalinists, and so on. And PANEL, the Independent Greeks, which was a neo-fascist party, both of which, by the way, were aligned with the Kremlin, interestingly enough, and had personal connections with important Russian political figures. And they were defeated by New Democracy, a center-right party. Again, not perfect. I don't endorse everything that they do and so on. But what an improvement and the return to more normal traditional democratic principles rather than the red-brown coalition that had governed before. And then one that is ongoing, and as I mentioned, is on the knife edge, the astonishing achievement of the Venezuelan opposition. I recently interviewed Maria Corina Machado, who is the primary leader of the opposition. What a courageous and brave person. She has not been allowed to leave the country for 7 years. She's in constant hiding as the state hunts her. And they achieved something amazing, not only an election in which they won, but they got the proof, the absolute proof of the vote tallies and the electronic, the QR codes that proved the outcome from one polling place to another of roughly 70 something percent of all of them, and showed that they had won by a 2-to-1 margin against Maduro, which is why the Venezuelan state refuses to release the tallies. They have to spend more time to fake it all and doctor it. They just stated without releasing any actual vote numbers, that they won by whatever, over 50%. The resilience, the courage, and the focus, the organizational abilities, using hundreds of thousands of volunteers, I find profoundly inspiring. Now, it's not a sure thing that Maduro and his dictatorship are going to leave. It could become extremely violent because the Russians and the Iranians in particular do not want to lose their toehold. So it's on a knife edge. But I am full of admiration and I am so inspired by what the people of Venezuela have accomplished and the liberal movement there. And to me, that says, even in very dark times, there is always hope.
Yeah, and I think your examples that you highlighted out there are like something that on very different levels are incredibly inspiring, but also show the different challenges that liberals face, like from the Venezuelan challenge, which is the most deep autocratic structure, to, for example, also the battlefields, that literally the war battlefields of Ukraine, to in the end something where political victory has happened with Poland. Whatever we make out of the current Polish government, there are some nuances to be seen there, and I mean it's tricky to govern there at the moment, where still the president of Poland is still from the Peace Party. But nevertheless, it showed as one example that populism can be defeated on electoral grounds, and people stood up for liberal democracy in the marches of Warsaw. So very remarkable stories. We would close off things with a thing that usually comes up with your talks naturally, because you always refer to a lot of books that people should read. I already made notes of like five more books that I should have a look at. But Maybe you give one thing to our listeners as a recommendation, a book that liberals should read but haven't read yet. Like, you know, if you recommend, read John Stuart Mill's On Liberty. I think some of our listeners have looked into that book, or at least are familiar with John Stuart Mill. But what would be a book that you think is deeply underrated and that liberals should read and haven't yet read?
May I mention two?
You might, but I mean, Tom, can I stop you? I don't think I have those powers, so therefore.
Okay. Well, one, I have recently been reading the work of Margaret C. Jacob, who's a very interesting historian. And her book on living the Enlightenment is quite readable and interesting. And it was on the civil society developments that undergirded liberalism and the growth of friendly societies and lodges and mutual aid groups and so on that practiced the principles of self-government and mutual respect. And so I find her work very interesting. So Margaret C. Jacob, I'm really enjoying reading her books, and I was only recently introduced to her, but she's taught me a lot. The other is a book by someone who hated liberalism. Every breath he drew had an anti-liberal hiss to it. He just hated our ideas. And that's Carl Schmitt, The Concept of the Political. It's a short book, and I think it's one of the most intelligent criticisms of liberalism yet written. And as it turns out, extremely relevant and influential today. The far left populists and the far right populists, when you read their books, you always find at the core Carl Schmitt, Carl Schmitt, Carl Schmitt, Carl Schmitt. His notion that the political, the concept of the political, is characterized by the distinction and the conflict between the friend and the enemy. This has been restated in almost unreadable gibberish by Ernesto Laclau and many others, but go back to the source book, Carl Schmitt. It's a short book. And I think you'll get a better understanding of the reasons why people reject liberalism and reject cosmopolitanism and reject a tolerant and pluralistic society. The notion that society must have one will, there's one true people with one will, and of course, one leader. This was articulated in German also, as a slogan of the previous dictatorship here. And now we're seeing it once again. And with it, the philosophy of the destruction of the individual for the state. I'll end with one scary thought. There was a statement from the Hitlerjugend, so the Hitler Youth Movement that enrolled young children into the promotion of this ideology of National Socialism and murder and violence. Wir sind zum Sterben für Deutschland geboren. So we are born to die for Germany. And the very same slogan is now being repeated in Russia, in Russian, but instead of Deutschland, it's Russia, it's Russia. And this idea is back. So we should read such books to understand what are the ideological touchstones of the anti-liberal revival.
Yeah, I mean, Carl Schmitt, one thing that I usually highlight there is it's the existential battle, right, of the friend versus the enemy. As you said with your last quote about the Hitlerjugend, I think this cannot be understated. It's not something in abstraction only, right? There is the existential battle, something that gives you meaning. That's another word for that, right? And that makes it so scary. I also read a lot of Carl Schmitt, unfortunately, but he's, I think, the most serious critic of liberalism, if you take it on an intellectual level. And I think that's also quite fitting why, for example, Jan Werner Müller, who wrote books on populism and also on the future of liberal democracy, is somebody who has read and wrote a lot about Carl Schmitt himself.
Yeah.
So I think that there, you see the ties there, right?
Quite difficult literature. On the other hand, to come back to the beginning of our talk and your first mentor, if I may call her that, pointing you to the enemies of liberty, and that you should know what they think. And I think we should reread those enemies' thoughts, because they return. And in order to recognize, you know, what path are others on? I think that could be quite helpful. So maybe read Carl Schmitt first and then Margaret Jacobs to end on a more hopeful note. And end is also my catchword right now. We have come to an end of this wonderful talk with you, Tom. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time. And I always say when we cite you or mention that you've been here in Gummersbach and so on, I always think, you know, someone, since you travel so much around the world and since decades now, you fight for liberty, for tolerance, for open societies, for a peaceful world. And I always think, you know, a liberal who doesn't know you should think about whether he's liberal or not, because he must have come across you at some point when engaging with the liberal promotion. So thank you so, so much for having this talk with us. Keep it up. We really also admire your work and whenever we can support you, we would love to give back what you have given to us so far.
You give it back so strongly. I'll tell you what makes me happy about IAF and what you do. And I'm going to be there soon for a program, I guess this coming weekend. And I like very much that you assemble such smart young people who embrace these ideas and want to develop them further, because I know that my time on the earth is limited. And it's very important to me to know that after I'm dust and ashes, there will be people continuing the fight for liberty. That matters to me a lot. And thank you for making sure that there will be new generations to embrace liberalism.
Wow, thank you, Tom. And with this, Sven, the word from you, please.
Yeah, we will certainly keep up that work, but we don't want to keep thinking about the bad things. So therefore, Tom, we are praying that you will stay with us for a long time and that, of course, progress will enable all of that too. Thanks for joining us. All our listeners, you can consider yourself a liberal now because according to Bettina's logic, are you really a liberal if you haven't heard from Tom Palmer? Then in this case, you have heard many interesting things from Tom today. So that makes you a well-equipped liberal in all books. And tune in for the next episode soon. And then subscribe and like, as they say. Okay, Bettina, that was a wild ride with Tom. Sometimes he's truly unstoppable. But I mean, that's the nature of a trailblazer, I guess. So many interesting thoughts, many things that we need to make sense of. Usually in Dahrendorf, we would take like, a reflection pair or something. And so we are doing kind of a reflection pair. So I will just ask you, what did you find most interesting or what was sticking with you? What was resonating? What do you chew on, like literally intellectually? What were some of the things that you are still processing?
Well, first of all, I mean, Tom is has covered so many areas politically, geographically, conflicts, feels a bit gloomy, or how do you say that? and at the same time, I think it's what we really need to do is to uncover the different conflict lines that we have here between those who would love to continue and fight for a liberal democracy around the world and those who want to destroy it. So, and he touched so many areas that we really need to find answers for as liberals. So one is the open conflict, the invasion, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but there also what's happening in Venezuela and other countries. There seems to be a lot of conflicts that on a second look are not independent from each other, without I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but there seems to be a lot of connection, and it comes back to not that many players who seem to be driving forces there. So that comes to my mind after this, after listening to Tom.
Yeah, and they are not ideologically necessarily combined, besides their hatred for the liberal values and liberal order, so to speak. But it's more like interest driven, I think. And I might have some quarrels with that particular position. But what I find most interesting with Tom's reflections is, of course, the need for a positive agenda of the liberals. Like, of course, pointing out that the challenges to liberal democracy or a rules-based international order, that's worrisome, and we should point it out. And we should say that we don't want people like Viktor Orban, Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, or Maduro. But on the other side, we also need to develop a positive agenda. I think there is a duty for liberals to deliver on their promise of progress. He made it, like, I think, most visible with the example of housing. I think if we want to show that material progress is still possible, we need to show that it is possible for all generations. And I think younger generations might feel with something as tangible as a flat or a house in the capital city, that this is not delivering, or the system is not delivering for them. And so we need to find ways, public policy is a good way to do so, to make affordable housing possible. And I think there are some liberals out there in the world that made this at the forefront of their policy agenda. And I think that's also something that the EIF, that in our urbanism seminars, we always have highlighted. And that's why we also think that is a political topic, like something as urban planning is fundamentally a political topic that liberals should embrace, similarly to, of course, a nuanced discussion of migration. So I find that most interesting. But of course, a lot to chew on in terms of intellectual thoughts, real world examples, but of course also a lot to put into our Amazon shopping lists, because there are a lot of book recommendations as usual from Tom.
And it also, reminds me that maybe we did become too complacent and lazy, because we thought, so now the liberal order and procedures are established and everything magically will fall into place, because that's what we expect when you have global cooperation, but that we need to do a lot of homework in our countries and really address the issues that make it so easy for the populists to abuse, to have people at each other's throats, basically, with envy, with hate, with fear, with all that negative emotions. And that we really need to do a lot more to show what positive we can achieve if we really cooperate in our nations, but also across borders, and do it hands on, not talk about, just do it, in a way.
Yeah, and just do it is the right cue for basically subscribing to this new podcast format. So stay tuned for upcoming episodes, and we will delve into much more topics in the upcoming future. So stay tuned and talk soon.